So now if you go to page 5, we're going to work through this. And now we're talking about how, is there a way back? I just hopped and skipped here and there historically. But if you want to understand how we got here, you really have to look at the history more carefully. And I mean, look at where reason emerged and what happened with it and what didn't happen with it and how it got here. And the late 1800s is especially important, but we need to have an idea of what is reason, what its function is, why you can't live without it, why it gets kicked around and shaped and reshaped in various ways by powerful institutions. So now, when I speak of Christian or Christian tradition of knowledge, in what follows, I shall be referring to what C.S. Lewis calls mere Christianity. And I hope that that's familiar to you. That is, the core beliefs of the main tradition of the Christian people through the ages. It is sufficient just to think of the cognitive content of the Apostles' Creed, if you can think cognitive content and Apostles' Creed in the same thing. And if you can't, try it. You'll like it. Failure to distinguish this central core from the many historical and accidental accretions to that tradition led the Christian institutions, churches, but also their colleges of the late 1800s and early 1900s, to irrational defenses of doctrines and practices that could not possibly be rationally defended. And when you read the Rubens book, you'll see right in the documents of the universities that it was this insistence upon the religious leaders in the colleges and universities on being irrational that gave rise to the institutional assumption that religion was irrational. And one of the things one has to learn to do in life is not to defend things that can't be defended. Well, that may not strike you as right, but it led to the identification of religion with irrationality and the deadly but false opposition of faith to reason. Religion became synonymous in many minds with blind dogmatism and blind adherence to authorities, and it's still often thought in that way. Faith, it is jokingly said, is what you believe even though you know it ain't so. Or Archie Bunker's definition, faith is what you wouldn't believe for your life if it wasn't in the Bible. Thus you hear people say today, and this was said recently, the national news somehow picked it up, that you can't be a scientist and believe in God. Well, poor Newton, poor Copernicus, poor Pasteur, and right on down the line. See, it's not an empirical claim, it's an a priori claim. I often have to challenge people who say these kinds of things. Have you studied empirically the difference in intelligence between believers and non-believers? Well, of course not. See, that's the modern day equivalent of the bishop who would not look through Galileo's telescope to see that Jupiter actually had moons. He said, I already know. When you supply the historical background of that comment, you can see why they might say that, though it remains a thoroughly ignorant statement. Now, so we have a peculiar history. As we stand here today, we have a peculiar history, and we deal with that history when we talk about the redemption of reason. And we see there are problems on many, many sides. Now, one standing outside the peculiar history referred to sees things very differently. Thus, Charles Malik, and I quote him here, if the university today dominates the world, if Jesus Christ is who the church and the Bible proclaim him to be, and if we happen to believe that what the church and the Bible claim about Jesus Christ is the truth, then how can we fail not only to raise the question of what Jesus thinks of the university, but to face the equally urgent demand, what can be done? Now, I want to say at this point, I don't think Malik's idea, and certainly it is not my idea, that the object is to prove that Christians are right. That's not the project. Now, that may be your project, and I wish you the best with it. But you have to stay, I believe, for whatever that's worth, that you have to stay out of that posture. And in general, that, I mean, just think about scientific theories. One of the things that so messes up the discussion around evolution and intelligent design and stuff like that today, I don't know if that's here on this campus, but it's hit other campuses like a cyclone of some sort. And one of the things that messes it up is the people on the two sides are trying to defend their theory rather than find out what good reasons there might be for thinking they're wrong. If you want to defend a theory, the way you do that is to try to find the best reasons for rejecting it. That's called falsification. And if you know the works of Karl Popper, that will be familiar to you. So when you read a statement like this by Malik, Malik is actually thinking about what's good for the university. He's not, and good for humanity that lives under the authority of the university. He's not thinking about how am I going to prove that we Christians are right. Now, you see, if you have the view of Jesus Christ that is spoken of in our songs and in our tomes of theology, we don't write those anymore, they used to be written, they're actually pretty good reading. If you look at what is said there, then you might think that this strange idea of Malik's, a Christian critique of the university, was the most important thing the university could do. Now see, that you just have to put on a different cap to think the thought that he's thinking. That, hey, there's a real danger here. You've got this huge thing, the university culture, and it's galumphing along trying to ignore Jesus. Well, what if it was galumphing along trying to ignore Einstein? What would you think? You would think it was in real trouble, wouldn't you? Am I making any sense at all? So you have to think outside of the defensiveness that has developed, especially in American Christianity. And you have to get outside of that conceptual box. And when you think about things like the scandal of the evangelical mind, you have to come to grips with the fact that most of the Christian colleges were not founded to advance truth, but to defend people from the other colleges. And that's hard for many people to come to grips with. See, that's where you earlier heard read Malik's statement about catching up in 100 years. And if you've read his material, you know he talks about how what he wants to see is the Nobel Prize winners coming out of the Christian schools. Now, I have some difficulty with the way that's set up institutionally. That may come up in the discussion, but the basic idea is right. And now you might think if what the Christians say about Christ is true, that would be a natural thing. It would be a natural kind of thing. But it can't be done if you're defensive. If you think the problem is to sort of that you're out here hanging on to the edge of the roof by your fingernails and about to fall off, and the big job is just to hang on. That's not the job. And Malik's statement here really does call us to realize that. I've tried this out. I remember I was talking, I think, with Graham about going to a college As often I'm invited to come to Christian colleges and to speak to them on faculty retreats and so on, going to one college and saying to them, who is the smartest man in your field? And they couldn't come up with much. And I said to them, Jesus Christ is the smartest man in your field. If it's 17th century French literature, he's still the smartest man in your field. You name the field. And I was saying to them in particular, if you're going to be disciples of Jesus, you'd better believe he's the smartest man in your field, or you're going to be somebody else's disciple. And that's what actually happens. And that's one reason why we see so little of the kind of work that Malik is talking about. See. And now I want us to put ourselves as best we can in Malik's position, outside the box and posture of current American religion and intellectual prejudices, and think that as followers of Jesus Christ, we have something vital to say and be in the university setting with reference to the intellect. So in that context, we're not just fending off stuff. That's not what our life is. And if you're in the position of a campus minister or someone, you're not just sort of, your job isn't fending off. See, it's leading people into a life of intellect. But now, you got company there. Because that's where Jesus is. See, that's the attitude on the basis of which Christianity came into the ancient world. And the intellectuals in the second and third century converted almost en masse to Christianity because they realized it addressed those issues. That's what is caught up in Paul's statement in Colossians 2. In him are hidden all of the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. So the binomial theorem is in there. 17th century French literature is in there. So you have to recategorize Jesus in order to begin to think these thoughts. Now, if you ask in an unsuspecting group of Christians who is the smartest man in the world, they will never come up with Jesus. A little kid who has been in Sunday school and has been told great things about Jesus might automatically identify him. But adults who have been weaned off of Sunday school stuff will certainly come up with someone else. And if you say, well, why didn't Jesus give Peter and John the relativity equations? Well, he had something more important to do. I'm not sure we're ready for them yet. Are you? He had something more important to do. And besides, they only had Roman numerals. You ever tried to do equations in Roman numerals? I suspect it's worse in Hebrew. So, think the thought that he brings ultimate knowledge of truth and goodness, and that we see the universe as a human system struggling to provide the knowledge necessary to life, but having set aside what he brought and brings. I often say the universe is very like a young person who, in their rebellion against their parents, has set aside all the basic good habits of life that would make it work. And yet they're out there still trying to make it work. That's really where we are. Now you walk around this campus and see all these marvelous buildings. I walked by the Union Church over here this morning, I guess it was. It had a little yellow piece of paper up in the display case that said, God is great and greatly to be praised. Well, what does that have to do with the case? See, is that true? Is that true? Now, if that's true, how could it be irrelevant to chemistry? Or the binomial theorem, and so on. If we are to bring that to life, human life, and I want to say something, by the way, you know, I often probably say things that are wrong. It seems to me that I couldn't possibly be an exception in that respect. So I think one of the things that we're apt to do is and I will challenge in a friendly way, the title of the book, The Two Tasks. They aren't two tasks. They are not two tasks. There's one. If you think they're two, you misunderstand how the Christian gospel came into the world. It came into the world as knowledge of reality. That's how it came into the world. And we miss the point if we try to separate it off and say, well, that's one thing. And then there's this other thing, by the way. And I will, since I've already admitted I might be wrong, I'll go ahead and say, you can't patch that second task onto the first if you've already distinguished them. If you have separated those two tasks, you'll never get them together again. Like Humpty Dumpty, it's all over. So, now one of the things we must do in our setting is to develop our own understanding of, there should be an of there, of what truth is and how it relates to life. This is really basic stuff, and I apologize because it sounds like it's just philosophy. But because of the nature of truth, it isn't just philosophy. And philosophy has done more than anything else to mess this issue up. Now, I mentioned in my previous perambulations that truth has been in bad odor for quite a long while around the university campuses. People don't want to touch it. I like to. I often in my classes, especially large freshman classes, I start out by saying, why are we here? Good question, actually. You would think if the university were a rational system, that'd be the first question we ask. Well, why are we here? You probably wouldn't be surprised to know how hard it is for students to answer that question. So I talk to them about knowledge and gaining knowledge and why that's important and how knowledge relates to truth. And I use simple illustrations of the harm that false belief does. You know, simple cases like believing your gas gauge is working and it's not. Now, what happens when that sort of thing, falsity, comes into your life? You have an unpleasant engagement with reality, right? For working purposes, you can define reality as what you run into when you're wrong. And suddenly, you know, the student begins to think, well, it was true for me that I had gas. It was true for me, but that didn't affect anything except me, put me in a position where I experienced a big letdown. The truth is a very simple thing. Children learn it very quickly. And if you've had children, you know that they learn it. You tell them you're going to do something you don't do. They don't say, like Pilate, what is truth? They don't say that. They say, Daddy! And you see, they know what truth is. And they know how important it is. That's why they learn to manage it by lying. You never have to teach a child to lie. They know how powerful truth and falsity are. They know what it is. It's a very simple thing. A statement or belief is true if it is about, if what it is about is as that statement or belief says it. Right? You know, that's a typical philosophical statement, but philosophical statements have to be kind of involved because that's the nature of what they're dealing with. Snow is white is true if and only if snow is white. Simple, isn't it? My belief that I have gas is true if and only if I have gas. Jesus rose from the dead if and only if Jesus rose from the dead. Right? That's the way truth works. Now, many truths are not simple. And actually, most of the interesting truths we deal with in university culture, they're not simple. The binomial theorem isn't simple, is it? But truth is always simple. Simply a matter of what you believe, your beliefs or your statements, what they represent, what they present to you is as they present it. If it's not, then it's false. Now, there are lots of quibbles. Obviously, some things can, in some sense, be more true than others. You can talk of degrees of truth. Your truth is very simple. Now, most of the efforts of dealing with truth that makes it relative move it to something else. And they decide, for various philosophical reasons usually, not to talk about truth. And truth becomes an embarrassment. And many of the things that we believe or teach, we have a hard time defending as truth. And so that, again, may make us want to back away from saying simply, well, truth is what it's about. Because if I belly up to that bar, then, again, I'm going to have to admit there are a lot of things I believe aren't true. And I'm going to have to be humbled before others who show me that what I believe is not true. And that's hard. And, again, we want to know. Aristotle opens his great book, Metaphysics, by saying, man by nature desires to know. This is proven by the delight we take in our senses, he says. And isn't that true? I mean, you want to see. You want to know. And that's tied to our sense of worth. You don't want to be someone who doesn't know. Like the lie most commonly told in our context is probably, oh yes, I've read that book. It's humiliating not to know. You ever notice how quickly little children, when you tell them something they didn't know, will say, I know. You ever notice that? See, that's very deep. That's soul stuff. That's way down there. And so truth is humiliating. There's a bitterness to truth. It's unyielding. It won't give to what you... Another thing that I usually take my beginning students through is I tell them, show me one truth that can be made true by believing it or wanting it to be true. There isn't any such thing. That's the bitterness of truth. It's totally unyielding. Pilate knew what truth was. That was his problem. But this is something that we have to do. Absolute truth is not a kind of truth, but a way of talking about how someone believes or holds something. Oh, is that an absolute truth? No. If I don't have gas in my tank, that's an absolute truth. Every truth is absolute. No truth is relative to what you believe or feel about it. Truth ain't like that. Belief is like that. And when someone says, oh, it's true for me, they don't mean it's true. And it's for them, they mean, I believe it. But of course, the human condition is, you can believe stuff and it be false. And that's where an absolutely indispensable role of reason comes in. So you can get killed because of reason. That's one reason why Jesus got killed. That's why Socrates got killed. People have, and again, in my little discussion about truth in class, I normally ask people, would you die for truth? Is truth something you would die for? Well, that's a pretty good question, isn't it? Especially if you're in the professions, especially if you're in a profession like journalism. See, truth is subversive. We mentioned earlier the statement, the truth will make you free. But the truth will also make you flee. And that's why that isn't what Jesus said. And you want to go back and read the full sentence in order to put it in perspective. Okay. Truth is not a social construct, though views often are false. Though views often are false views as well as true ones. Views have to be constructed, but the fact that they're constructed does not mean that they do not deal with something that is not constructed any more than the fact that I walk in steps means that I don't touch the ground. Walking in steps is how I touch the ground. Having views is one way of contacting reality. You are not a dogmatist or a Nazi if you understand truth in this way. Many people identify liberalism with a relativist view of truth. And after these talks, I've had students come and say, well, that was very convincing, but you know I'm a liberal. And so I can't believe that. You talk about a piece of reasoning. Now there's one. Okay, the recovery of truth in this clear and traditional sense is indispensable for the redemption of reason. So if we, as scholars, as thinkers, Christian or not, want to establish a point of reference, we have to go through understanding truth in something like this way. And again, I apologize because even if you talk about this in this way, many people say, oh, you're a closed-minded dogmatist, you don't, no. That's the whole point, is there's something for you to be open-minded about. And there is a reason why you should be open-minded, because if you're not, you're going to miss something that's really very important. But if you have that, then, and now I'm the top of the next page there, you can have it. It will serve as a guiding star for thought in its appointed function, which is precisely discovery of truth. That is what someone spoke about, a teleological view. Yes, that's what it's for. That's what reason is for, is to discover truth. That is why logic is important. We'll talk a little bit about that in a moment. Now, of course, the particular truths which Jesus Christ brings into the world then have at last a field of play in open and fair competition with alternative claims for truth. But we must distinguish truth itself from truths of whatever kind, which, unlike truth itself, often are complicated and recondite. And so that's why research is such serious business, regardless of what field it is in, because truth does not present itself easily in most fields. And theologically, I believe one reason for that is to give us chance to grow to the point to where we can stand the truth, which is one reason why God has withheld technological process in history and let it out as slowly as he has. But that's a longer story. So having done this now, we clarify to our minds and others what knowledge is, and I suggest, so this is just a suggestion, try this on. We know any given thing if we're able to represent it as it is on an appropriate basis of thought and experience. That's what knowledge is. Now this is absolutely central. And when you're dealing with people about any issue, one of the things that you have to get clear on is what they count as knowledge. if they say that something like, well, science, then don't proceed with the discussion. Go back now and talk about science. And this is one of the main forms that the institutionalism of reason has frozen many, many important discussions in, by trying to talk about what is scientific and what is not. Right? So we go back to the intelligent design discussion. One thing that comes up over and over and over is, oh, it's not scientific. Well, there may be some important sense in which that's true. And actually, I think there's a great deal to be said on that. Not for this conference, but so there's a lot to be said there. But the fact that something is not scientific does not mean it's not knowledge. Nearly everything you know, everything that brought you to this room today, is knowledge, and it's not scientific knowledge. Now, one response to that, I say, well, it's not knowledge, right? But that's an arbitrary definition. So now, just try that on. See, knowledge, if you're right, that doesn't mean you know, because you can be right without having an appropriate basis. So if you bet on a race and you win, that doesn't mean you know, does it? If you know, the police would like to talk to you. I don't know what they do here in Illinois, but California, they don't think you're not supposed to know. You can be right, but see, authority is indispensable. It is one of the sources of most of the things that we know. And there's nothing wrong with authority. And it functions all day long in every science. And that's not a bad thing. Remember, an appropriate basis of thought and experience. So just move over quickly to the issue of revelation. What better reason could you have for believing something other than that God said it? Ooh. Well, of course, there's an issue of whether or not God said it, isn't there? Right? And that requires a lot of work. But the idea, if you, many people, for example, think, well, you shouldn't consider revelation, but they don't believe in God anyway. Now, if there's no God, forget about revelation. Right? So you don't want to be caught arguing with people about revelation as a source of knowledge if they don't even believe in God. And then, of course, there isn't just God. There's the tradition of the Bible, the forms the Bible comes in, the communities of interpretation around them. All of that goes into the mix. And we have to regard that. There's in science, in all fields, art, there are institutions of interpretation. That doesn't mean there's no truth, there's no reality. It just means we have to learn how to deal with that. Authority is indispensable. The important thing is that any in authority must be open to all questions. Right? So you know that in your family, when you have to draw yourself up and say to your child, because I'm your father. Well, the discussion was over some point before that, wasn't it? Now, sometimes in human affairs, you have to stop the discussion, but that's never a reason for accepting, other than some sort of necessary thing, like we have to decide who's going to have the car tonight. All that religion requires of philosophy, as L.T. Hobhouse once said, is a fair field and no quarter given. And that is especially true for followers of Christ. No matter what you're dealing with, if you could find a better way, Jesus would be the first to tell you to take it. You can't imagine him standing there and saying, well, it's better, but you know, it's not Christian. If you imagine that about him, you don't really have much confidence in him. So, knowledge requires truth. You can't know what is not true. You cannot know that for which you have no basis. And reason, of course, comes in to deal with the basis. And it sifts and winnows, as my old school says, and its aim is to arrive at the truth. And what it requires is simply openness. And one of the things, of course, that reason does is, in the manner that Plato saw long ago, it limits what it itself can do. Reason has to have something to work on. Not that you have to stop thinking at that point, but it has to have something to work on. And the old computer saying, garbage in, garbage out, is basically what you see in many cases where reason goes to work. You should note also that you don't have to know that you know in order to know. This is an old sophistry. You have to put it aside. Kids know stuff all the time. They don't even know what knowing is. Right. And this is where you have to go back and you have to decide what knowledge is. Individually, you have to make up your mind what knowledge is. But one of the things that we want to understand is that you don't have to know that you know in order to know. You should understand that what counts as an appropriate basis will vary from subject matter to subject matter. There's no general formula for such a basis. Experienced people in any field have a good sense of when such a basis is there and when it's not. Not an infallible sense. You don't have to be infallible to know. To know, you don't have to be in a position of saying, I couldn't possibly be wrong. You just have to be able to represent things as they are on an appropriate basis of thought and experience. Now, those of you who are ministers and working with the scripture and so on, you want to understand that the scripture, as it exists in our world, is a part of the structure of evidence, not just for Christianity. It is a part of the structure of evidence for life and the universe. And you say, well, what about the Bhagavad Gita? Bring on any comers. Everything is open to inquiry. You exist in a community within which you practice the humility of the mind. Paul has a wonderful phrase, humbleness of mind, in Colossians 3. And so we don't rule out things. We don't need to. Okay, well, let me move on here. You'll notice the truth and knowledge and logic, as here described, you have to work logic into this. They do not automatically rule out any area of thought or practice out of the domain of knowledge. Now, that contrasts with many understandings of knowledge in the Western tradition that do automatically rule areas out. Whether there is knowledge in a given area or case is a matter of details. Now, this is what we've talked about earlier about with reference to theology. Theology as a discipline, as an intellectual discipline, and you will correct me, please, has basically disappeared. And if you go back and read theology books written before the Second World War, especially earlier, you see an entirely different structure. It was assumed that it was a cognitive structure. But that area has been assumed not to be an area of theology used to be standard course available even to people in the so-called secular state schools. And now, I think at Notre Dame you can still study theology as something that looks like knowledge, not just historical. But that's what happens when knowledge is defined in such a way that it automatically rules out whole areas of inquiry. One of the good things postmodernism, to speak loosely, has done is to reject the idea that there is just one story about knowledge. And in particular, to reject the hegemony of natural sciences, mainly physics. And that's a good thing. Okay. So now, the greatest mistake among Christian thinkers and institutions over recent centuries has been to allow the secular mind to define what counts as knowledge. And this is where you have to take a stand if you're going to come to this area of the redemption of reason. You have to work out something that will allow you to go on with the discussion. And that is what opened the way to the required assumption of atheism practically at least, God making no difference in all areas of knowledge and practice. The opposite of that assumption is not theism, by the way, but openness to facts and inquiry without adherence to some narrow and prejudiced understanding of what counts as knowledge. Now, let me jump on to the next page briefly. It may be of use here, when we're thinking about the claims of a particular field, it may be of use here to think of adequacy of content in course content or research. Is the treatment that a subject area receives, whatever your area is, French literature, mathematics, or whatever, is the treatment adequate? That's what we all stand under as researchers, as people, is the adequacy of our treatment of a subject matter. And there are three respects in which we might think of. For example, is it adequate in the eyes of our fellow professionals? And that is the trap that reason and research falls into, is thinking that that's the only standard of adequacy. Now, of course, our fellow professionals have to make judgments about us. They might write letters or vote in committees and so on about us, and so that matters. But one has to understand that your treatment could be adequate in the eyes of fellow professionals and not be adequate in terms of human needs, the second standard of adequacy. And then the third standard of adequacy would be adequacy to the subject matter itself. I think you can see that these are rather different standards, and whether the traditional body of Christian knowledge, as I refer to it, concerning practice as well as theory, is relevant to adequacy of treatment in a given field will depend on which of these serve as the standard of adequacy. A good way to proceed might be to scrutinize the unanswered questions in the given field, your field, of course. Through force of habit, these might not be obvious. We may then need to go back to what is obvious in our field. Genius, it has been said, is the ability to scrutinize the obvious. And doing this may yield results that will make you look like a genius. Indeed, it is a good rule in intellectual work to mistrust the obvious. I would say an absolutely indispensable rule. What is taken as obvious in your professional context is the very place that you want to begin if you're thinking in terms of the redemption of reason. Because the primary form of slavery of reason is, it's obvious. Obvious. Isn't that what you run into when you try to raise some fundamental, oh, it's obvious. Right? Or that's out of the question. Who's asking the question? It's like the bumper sticker, war is not the answer. Well, what was the question? So that's where we begin to dig in, possibly, as Christian thinkers who have something to say for the benefit of others. Would anything intellectually interesting appear, for example, about why the physical universe has the laws it does, why mathematics works, the possible forms of energy, the function of the art object in aesthetic creation or creation or appreciation, or why the life of Napoleon or Teresa of Calcutta turned out as it did? What language is, the nature of human beings, spiritual reality in the human, the mind and the brain, and so on. So these are the kinds of things that we would start thinking about if we were going to bring what I'm calling the body of Christian knowledge over against the kinds of research that we do in all of our fields today, if we were interested in the issue of intellectual adequacy of content. Those are the kinds of things. Now, you know better than I about your field. So that's why I'm saying, well, go back and look at it. When you're raising this question of the relevance of God, to speak simply, to your field, be sure to look at the things that are assumed to be obvious. And then begin to find the unanswered questions, and that's the way of going forward. Well, there are a lot of deeper issues here. I just mentioned two on the last page, and you can read this for yourself. Of course, we're not just talking about intellectual work. The separation between intellect and life is one of the things that we must most strongly protest against. And for those of us who believe there is a God, and that he's great and greatly to be praised, would be living in his kingdom. Right? We wouldn't be actually over here running our kingdom in neglect of his if we thought that that was actually true. So when Jesus comes and he says, you know, think it out again, folks. The kingdom of God is now available to you. Well, see, that's truth. That's reality. That's his. See, Jesus answers the main questions of life that everyone has to respond to. What is real? Who is well off? Who's a really good person? And how do you get to be a really good person? And if you like a fifth one, how do you get to be really well off? I don't like to separate those two, that's a longer story. So finally, on your page 8 there, the last paragraph, the deeper critical issues concerning the failure of self-understanding of reason or research in its modern modes is something I cannot pursue here. This failure deeply affects the universities and our general culture. I cannot stress anything as strongly as it needs to be on that point. The failure of self-understanding of research or reason in its modern modes. But I would just say that it is a hugely important matter for humanity, that it is widely recognized as such by leading philosophers. I refer you to Edmund Husserl's work, and especially to his Crisis of European Sciences. And by the way, I think Saturday there will be a paper read on this topic involving Husserl and the recent Pope and some other people. A much simpler treatment I give you is found in H.W.B. Joseph's Some Problems of Ethics, Chapter 1. I might mention also Albert Schweitzer's book on civilization and ethics. Unfortunately, Mr. Schweitzer is a person who has more or less disappeared from the intellectual horizon, but I do urge you, if you don't know that book, Civilization and Ethics, to go back to it. And you can find further discussions of a lot of this stuff on the philosophical side of my webpage. My webpage suffers from schizophrenia. Has religion and philosophy. John, shall we just go into questions?
Just one point to make. On the web page, hopefully within a week, Chap in the Corner is recording all of these talks, and they will be available on the web. Too cumbersome to think about selling recordings, either CDs or tapes, so it's just available to everybody. I've come in and connect with the meeting's notes here and the lecture.
Thank you, John. Now, who did I say was first? Was that person here? Yes, sir.
Would you please comment on your understanding of the relationship between being reason and being a person?
Yes. Redeeming the person means to buy them back from their bondage to death and loss. That comes from trusting their natural energies. That's what it means. Now, reason, if it is rightly pursued, will make clear the devastating nature of this problem and how it cannot be solved simply by human abilities. And there are a lot of pretensions that it can be solved. Other ways it might be solved. But reason, when it is rightly used, draws the limit on what you can do in certain ways. And ideally, reason would bring you to the place to where you would find salvation. Now then, that's deliverance, that's redemption. Now then, well, what about other versions of salvation? What about the Buddhist version or some other, or the atheist version? They all have versions of salvation because all of them answer those four questions that I listed. So you have to look at all of them. And that's the only honest thing to do in the face of reason. What can the Buddha bring to you in the way of salvation? Good question. And you don't go at it defensively. See, you try to learn from any source that you can. And so reason, in part, gives you the capacity to do that process of discernment that you go through. Now, but you say, well, what about spiritual discernment? Okay, what about anything? And you're open and you consider that. Now, if what I'm saying is true, reason is a very weak faculty. It has a specific function, but many dangers, and it needs help. But that's something to be tested by life. Right. So you don't... Salvation, as I understand it, for human beings, is not available through reason alone. But you'd better not set it aside in the face of a God who says, come now, let us reason together. So that's a deep question, but we have to keep it in that perspective, I think. Now, who got the second question? It was a lady. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that that's been eroded. And I think everyone would agree that the modern university, with its university, is equally corrected. But I am thinking about the fact that everybody has these diverse worldviews, and that wrenches all of our truth plans. Mm-hmm.
The question is, how do you honor diversity in the educational system? One thing, to state negatively, you cannot return to the past. And it's a good thing you can't. The reason why the university system in its Christian forms fell apart was because it was weak. And it was primarily weak precisely on the point of reason. See, in the late 1800s, it was very customary for someone, perhaps a university president or an outstanding minister in the community, to give a course to seniors in which they brought it all together, wrapped it in a bow, and handed it to them and said, now, this is your worldview. When you go back and look at those lectures, you will observe that they were extremely abstract. They did not deal with the details of how things worked in a given field. I mentioned Herbert Spencer's sociology and so on. Well, what is distinctive about Herbert Spencer's sociology book, you can look it up, is not just that it said nothing about God, but that it tried to discuss the details of social life. And that is what broke that older model down, and you cannot return to it. In general, you don't think in terms of imposing truth on anyone. And that actually is what I'm speaking against, because I think we now have a secular church that is in charge of intellectual culture and imposes truth on people. And the teachings of Foucault and other about force in the intellectual world is really serious stuff to think about. Diversity can be a mindless imposition, and for most people it is. They respect it verbally, they have no idea why it's important. It's only if you have a loving and intellectually thorough approach to the facts of human existence, especially in institutions, that you can see why diversity is important. And in this respect, old John Stuart Mill, in his essay on liberty, in the part where he discusses why you don't repress minority opinions, really says about all you need to say. But now you see, you have these things get wild and they take on a different form. In this country today, we have something, I mean, he's worried about majority repression. Now you have minority oppression in this country. What is impression? Well, the old impression of minorities was a king, right? Who manages this society? Who is in charge of it? That's a good question to ask. And you have a lot of confusion in the public about what it means to be democratic, a constitutional democracy, and various kinds of issues that are unsettled because we are operating blindly on things like diversity and oppression and so on. See, many people on our campuses, they talk about diversity, but that's, what does it mean to them? So suppose you were to say, well, the real ground of diversity is a moral teaching that comes out of Jesus' teaching that you should love your neighbor as yourself. And then you begin to find out they don't even love the people they're diverse about. Okay? In this country, you don't have to love your neighbor, you just don't discriminate, or discriminate equally, I guess. See, that's what happens when we lose the point. The monsters, as Goya painted, that arise when reason sleeps. But see, we don't recognize. We think, well, they all look so nice. They come with PhDs, and so forth and so on. They're still monsters. And reason is the only thing that can help us with that. And life in the kingdom of God is not the same thing as life in, you name the denomination or institution. And it's the kingdom of God that we live in that sets us free to love God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength, and our neighbor as ourselves. So what if that doesn't fit in with my professional group? Well, that's not the end of the world. That's not new, is it? You follow truth. You follow good reason. You're open. You're thoughtful. You listen. You're able to hear other people. The first act of love is attention. You love your neighbor, better pay attention to them. Listen to them. Instead of trying to give them the answer, ask them a good question. There are different ways of doing this. But your question is extremely important, and how to live as a person who actually believes in the teachings and person of Jesus in a context such as the university, a part of that answer is you actually do love your neighbors as yourself. And one of my neighbors was Jacques Derrida. Until he died, he's moved on now, but he's one of my neighbors. So I don't just criticize him, I love him. Yeah, that's beautifully said. That's beautifully said. How do you teach it? What would the answer be? Well, for one thing, you know that in teaching, as in research, the question is always relevance. You never inject stuff that's irrelevant to what you're doing in your course. If it is relevant, on the other hand, then you have a duty to deal with it. That's a duty. But of course, you're not going to do any of that in a way that is closed-minded and dogmatic and preachy. Now, how are you going to do that? That's going to come out of your spirit. And you do have problems with understanding, because for many people, if you even mention something, you're being dogmatic. Right? I deal constantly with, in metaphysics, I have to deal with evolution as a cosmic theory. And I have to point out things like, look, you can't treat evolution as a theory of creation because it presupposes a very complicated system already in existence before you can talk about evolution. Right? But for you, if you watch students, and many of them are very uneasy if someone suggests that there might be a criticism associated with the word evolution. Well, that's you. I mean, you have to overcome that by your spirit, by your gentleness, by the way you open the question up, the way you qualify what you're doing, and so on. And there are limits beyond which you cannot go, because it's just the nature of social, the social setting. There's some people, as I mentioned in the earlier talk, even to raise a question is to show that there's something wrong with you. Now, you cannot, you always want to remember that there is a time to die. And we don't want to make a big flourish and deal of it, but very simply, and there is a time. There is a time to walk into the buzzsaw. And actually, one of the most instructive people, one of the most instructive things you can do for the people standing around is to let them watch how you do it. And that may mean you're not going to get the prize. That's people say bad things about you and so on. But again, that's just par for the course. Right? And even those who simply had reason alone to go on, understood. And we have teachings in the Bible that are very profound about it. In Leviticus, we're told, you shall not follow a multitude to do evil. Hey, you talk about the redemption of reason. That's it. So, that's a very important question. I hope that's some sort of a response to it, but actually it requires a lot of living and thinking for it. Are there any other comments or questions? John, you've been following. Could you?
I apologize if my question is not fully germane right now, but you spoke a lot about the redemption of reason from the context of a researcher or a teacher in the university period. And this is rather vague, but what do you have to say about redeeming reason as being a student, from my perspective, of how to shift through these questions of knowledge and what is true on the seeing?
Well, I don't think it's all that different, because you are in a weaker power position in the university, and your experience has not given you a lot of resources that you might have later on. It's more difficult, but basically you keep the same questions. What is truth? What is knowledge? What is a good reason? And you question your teachers. Now here you have to be gentle, because you will find very quickly, if you ask the wrong questions, many teachers get on the offensive. And so then, as a Christian, what you need to know is you have found someone who needs you to love them. And so perhaps instead of drawing them out in class or before others, you may want to go to their office. They'll feel more comfortable there. And raise your questions. And sometimes you take a beating, because actually what comes out is the attitude, you wouldn't be raising that question if you weren't stupid. Now, this is terrible, but this goes on in classrooms all the time. And there, sometimes a person can actually help a teacher, especially a young teacher, by just befriending them and cultivating a sense of humor and praying for them. The position of the professor is one that is very threatening. For example, many professors think that they should be right all the time. And it's a terrible burden to carry. So, you know, you should just give up at the first day. One of the things I do to help my students focus on logic is tell them, if I at any point say that a certain argument is valid or invalid, and you can show that I am wrong, I will give you an A in the course. But see, that's a way of bringing out that actually I could be wrong. You know? And so it's very tense. I know, I don't think my students are frightened of me. After, especially, you know, you got 6 or 7 weeks into the semester. But even so, the best students in my classes, if I ask a question and they answer it, they will answer it in a whisper. Because they are so paralyzed by the fear. I don't think they're afraid of me, they're afraid of the other people in the class. And they want to hear someone else whisper the same answer, and then they'll say it louder. See, it is a very threatening context. And I think you just accept it as such and abandon yourself to God and keep thinking. Was there another hand? Yes, over here, good. We got three. Yes.
Using reason, right, cruel as it is, to help people rediscover reason is true.
Mm-hmm.
I'm more theologically trained in, you know, looking at, say, Romans 1, where it talks, where Paul talks about how people through wickedness suppress the truth.
Right.
It seems to suggest another important prong, and that is that we must appeal to people's conscience, which Paul argues people have.
Right.
Do you have anything to say about how do we speak to people's conscience? I mean, you talk about loving people like that, there's a ground, but is it?
Well, you have to listen a lot. You really do. If you're going to speak with someone on these matters, you really have to listen to them. And sometimes a question will help them more than an assertion, unless they've asked. See, when they invited Paul up on Mars Hill to talk, well, they asked. So he said, I'll tell you. And that's what he should have done. But in many of our situations in the university, the circumstance is really more delicate than that. And I found that people have to be sure you're not going to run over them before they'll open up in a way that you can really help them. And that means, among other things, that you're not going to try to manage them and try to get them somewhere that they at present don't want to go, even though you may know they really need to go there. So, you know, reason isn't the answer to every question, but it is an important part of an answer to a big question. And the big question here is, how do you redeem reason or research from a position in which it has become self-blinded and help it understand what's going on, and then begin to move back into the freedom which reason is designed to give. Now, what Paul, of course, is dealing with is what happens when you refuse to retain God in your knowledge. If you recall, that's where that whole declension starts in Romans 1. And Romans 1 is one of the most important passages to study for understanding the university scene. And you see, if you throw away certain truths, you're messed up in the rest of the field. That's the nature of knowledge, is to be orderly. And so Paul starts out, you remember, in that passage by saying, what can be known of God is clear. Now, wow, have we got a place to start there? Let's see. And when you get in there, you realize that it's in the margin of the consciousness of nearly everyone in the university setting to keep God at a distance. This is not a small thing, because think about it. What it means is, if they're wrong about that, they're wrong about their whole field. They're wrong about life in general. I mean, how could you be more wrong than to think there was no God when there was one? How could you be more wrong? You couldn't be more wrong. That's the biggest deal in the whole universe. And that's why everyone is so touchy about this. It's because they know if they don't keep that away, they're incompetent. Now, maybe they've got some little areas of competence, but they know that the whole deal is shot. So it's a real issue to listen, to be sensitive, but above all, we can't dismiss being thoughtful. Have we got a few minutes more? We've got two more people over here just dying to ask questions. And I'll promise I'll answer quickly. Yes. Oh, my advice to parents is sit in on classes, get to know the professors. Oh, well, sure it does. Now you're going to get me in hot water for sure. I mean, know your school, know your teachers. And don't leave your children just at the mercy of whatever comes down as respectable. That may mean pulling them out and putting them in other schools. It may mean that you do as much or more teaching than anyone else. But don't leave your hands off of it. Another thing is don't get grim and ferocious about it. That really hurts the child. Keep a sense of joy and confidence in God, and find ways of counteracting what may be coming down. But it's also very important for parents to go to the university classroom. Talk to the faculty. Know what's going on. And that's very important. Okay? Say something. Right.
Work. And I'm just so thankful for this conference and for your coming here and for the opportunity that we have, if we wait upon God and follow Him, to have an influence in American academic life.
Yes.
Just praying diligently, and there's no end to what God can do.
That's right. And we can rest in that. And that means, among other things, we don't have to get anxious about outcomes. We're not in charge of outcomes. One final point. Yeah.
Then we also have to be careful that that moralism doesn't itself become worldly and oppressive and the flow, as you said. I'm thinking of there are plenty of instances of that happening. I'm thinking of the English Wycliffites, for instance, who spoke Christian truth to Christians and were then persecuted in the name of Christianity, in the name of morality.
Right.
That
falls. Well, that's the human condition. And that's why your confidence must be in the kingdom of God and not in any institution, even if it's called, if it's a religious institution. And so you have to constantly return, the kingdom of the heavens is at hand. That means wherever I'm standing, it's right there. And that's what I trust, and that's what I lived before. And in that, I can be faithful, even if religious institutions are burning me at the stake. And you have to live that way. And it's easy to do. In fact, the hard part is to live any other way. We just think the other way is easy because we have that habit. The easy way is to turn it all loose. And if people want to burn you, that's their business. God deals with it. So, as I said in the earlier talk, religion needs redemption also. And any human institution needs that. And the great illusion of illusions is the idea if we just get in the right institution, then everything's fine.